is what I can.
A reflection, really. I mean, it's come up from time to time over the years, but it's come up again now. And I just feel that I really don't know the difference, if it can be known, between death and the deconstruction of the independent self.
Between death?
Yeah.
I mean, are you speaking about physical death?
Yeah. But somewhere in my mind, there's no distinction.
You think that that is the time when the deconstruction of a self would happen?
Or there's a fear that the deconstruction of the independent self is like a death. Or I think it will be the end of me as I currently experience myself, which it probably would be, but I can't differentiate that from actually dying for some reason, somewhere in my mind.
I mean, I think I'd prefer to reframe that a little bit, if you don't mind. For any of you who are at all familiar with the Buddha's teaching, he's very directly concerned with the world of our experience. And in fact, when he talks about the world, he always talks about the world of experience, because clearly we do live in different worlds. You know, source of problem in our communications often, but we do live in the world of our own experience. And he devised, you know, a very profound and very traceable process to describe the constructing of that world of experience, which includes the constructing of my sense of self within that world of experience. And it's a teaching that in Pali it's Paticca Samuppada, translated in English, it's the world of dependent arising. Now, it describes a kind of cyclical existence, the cyclical creation, the way that we walk in circles, you know, that we're very familiar with, the way that we walk in circles psychologically and emotionally, often following these very familiar tracks. And within that process that's described, of course, it is a cycle, it's not a one-way street. You know, we often see our life as being a one-way street, beginning at birth and ending in death. Whereas in that description, of course, it's a wheel, it's a circle, which includes birth and death. So in that, the encouragement is of the Buddhist teaching is to see how our world is constructed from contact to feeling to craving to becoming and to birth. The birth of the I am in that moment. Okay? And, well, you know, that's very traceable in our experience in many ways. You know, if you take a simple example again, you know, I have contact with a sight. You know, I walk outside and perhaps I see one of you who reminds me of my mother. You know, I see you. There's a perception in that. There's a feeling in my case. It would be a mixture of pleasant and unpleasant. But if I went down the pleasant track, then the thoughts would begin. I'd be remembering my mother. I'd be longing for my mother. I'm becoming lonely or alienated. And then I arrive, you know, oh, I am this person. Now that is a birth. That is a process of birthing, of becoming something quite solid in the moment, that would feel quite solid in the moment. And then, of course, I could continue my walking and, you know, see something else, see someone who, you know, sort of has a different association for me. And that birth, that becoming, would die. And a new process would begin. A new process would begin. And so, when the Buddha spoke about birth and death, you know, he always spoke about what actually can be traced within our world of experience, rather than this one-way street to see how that process of birth and dying is something that is happening many, many times in a single day in terms of the birthing and the dying of a particular self-view that is happening many, many times in a single day. So, of course, his sense of liberation was not to be, that this walking in these cycles with these endless birthings and dyings, it's not a terminal condition. It's not a terminal condition, and at any point in that process of constructing a world of experience and constructing the self of the moment, the process can be interrupted at any moment. Because remember, he is speaking about a process that's being driven by confusion, not this being driven by understanding, a process that's being driven by confusion. And so he says that process, that cycle of confused becomings and births and deaths, can be interrupted at any moment through the intervention of mindfulness or investigation, of questioning, of insight. And so when the Buddha speaks about the deathless, he's also speaking about the birthless. He's speaking about the cessation of that process of this sense of world and self being shaped, which does feel so incredibly convincing in the moment, doesn't it? I mean, when I really have worked myself up into being a lonely person or an angry person or a mindless person, that there's a certain amnesic quality to that.
Yeah.
Like I've forgotten that yesterday I wasn't, or even 10 minutes ago I wasn't. Or in 10 minutes from now I won't be. So there's a certain kind of amnesia quality within that process which makes it, of course, even more convincing. So seeing that with some immediacy, personally, I feel is far more helpful than the kind of more philosophical or abstracted view of, that moment of death and that disappearance, that ultimate or final disappearance of me as I know myself, to see that with some more immediacy, I personally find to be much more helpful.
Yeah. So do I, now you said that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, on a sort of similar note, I suppose, I've been reading a bit about those three states of being, whatever, the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. I wonder if you could talk a bit about the sense of deep sleep, where the self sort of is, what
not
the language
there, is.
It? Well, that's it, but it doesn't feel like it to me. But
well, it doesn't feel like it's there.
No.
Well, how could it be there?
No.
If your cognition is not working, your contact is not working.
Mm-hmm.
If the contact moments are not working, then there's no trigger for, cognition, for proliferation, for identification. So it's a wonderful thing we can sleep. that even there are at least some brief moments of respite from endlessly selfing. Otherwise, I think we would all die of exhaustion.
Yeah, sure. And I've been also reading some of that Vedanta stuff like Ramana Maharshi and people like that. He talks about that as being like the true sort of the true ground, or something along those lines.
He didn't recommend people sleep through their lives. No.
No, but there's something about that state of deep sleep. I've heard it sort of being described as being the true self.
Well, I don't know. It's a different languaging, It's a completely different languaging in Advaita than it is in Buddha psychology, because, the words true self or whatever wouldn't really feature in Buddha's teaching. But actually, experientially, actually, as I mentioned this morning, we actually, I think, probably encounter many, many more moments than we actually appreciate where selfing is not actually operative. And it's very important, I think, very significant to be aware that, you know, the magnitude of selfing exists primarily in relationship to that which is unhelpful, unskillful, and unwholesome,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the decrease in the selfing really is related to all of those qualities of heart, you know, generosity, patience, forgiveness, metta, compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the moments when the voice of selfing really mutes. So I think that gives us a lot of clues.
Mm.
You know, I think it gives us really some very important clues, because we have moments, of course, in our day, you know, when there is an unhesitating kindness or an unhesitating
mm-hmm.
responsiveness or, you know, an unhesitating compassion. We have moments in our day where there are moments of wholeheartedness, you know, seeing, listening, sensing wholeheartedly. We have many, perhaps not as many as we like, but I think those moments in our day are not strangers to us. And you really sense how in those moments both the sense of selfing and the sense of othering really begins to mute. And so I think that actual sensing of that in our own experience really provides some very powerful clues. Because we see, if we really want to, you know, continue to feel locked within and struggling within the sort of confines of you know, this embattled me, just cultivate the unwholesome. It's a sure prescription, you know. If we really feel a longing to kind of open those doors, you know, and to feel that contractedness turn into non-contractedness, then I think the clues are there within our own experience in terms of what is cultivated, you know, what is really tended to, what is really brought into being in terms of those skillful, healing, liberating qualities of heart.
Mm. So in those moments, and when the self does drop away, isn't that kind of is the deathless, isn't it? I mean, that's just where there is just awareness or just compassion. And so that's kind of essentially, when everything else drops aside, that is what we all share.
I think it's a glimpse.
Mm.
I think it's a glimpse. I think it's a taste. You know, I mean, certainly from the context of the Buddha's teaching, when he speaks about the deathless or the end of becoming, you know, he is speaking about the cessation of all confusion and all delusion, not as a temporary respite, you mm. know, but really as really that uprooting.
Mm-hmm. I still had a question, but I think you kind of answered already. Right? It was just about when one's caring for others, so young, elderly, say, there is a sense, I think, of not being self at those times. But it can sometimes move into almost wanting to create a self for them. I noticed when I was thinking, when I was walking, I suddenly became aware of someone I care for and thinking that that is a time when I'm not thinking about me. And I can sometimes almost give too much of myself at those times. And how to kind of hold on to enough of me that I don't exhaust myself in giving.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, sometimes you hear the proposal that first you have to have a healthy self before you let go of self, you know, and you have to preserve boundaries, and, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, I think that there's two slightly different kind of philosophies operating here, you know, and I, you know, we do see in our culture people who are overextended, overfatigued. You know, we hear words like compassion fatigue, you know, and generosity fatigue and all of those things. And often our response to either seeing that in others or seeing that in ourselves is, you know, oh, I have to preserve something, you know, I have to keep something. I think from the perspective of the Buddha's teaching, you know, the idea of a healthy self is actually put forward quite differently, I think. It's very clearly acknowledged in this teaching, this path, you know, that all of the qualities such as inner dignity, inner respect, inner care, compassion, kindness, that these are all necessary components for us to be in this world in a healthy, generous and respectful way. You know, to put the notion of a healthy self on that would probably be something, an optional extra. It's not necessary. But clearly the whole teaching is rooted in care. The whole teaching is rooted in care. You okay? Would you like some water? And I think sometimes when people have got into that place of being overextended and overstretched and over compassion fatigue, at some point they have stopped listening inwardly, actually, to the well-being of their own bodies, hearts, and lives. You know, and that, you know, I quite love that teaching that says, you know, to care for others and neglect oneself is not compassion. You know, to neglect oneself and to care for oneself and neglect others is not compassion. So, you know, it's not this sense of I need to sort of preserve this, and I have so much to give, and then the tank runs dry, you know, and then I need to refill the tank. I think it's much more of a sense of that quality of sensitivity inwardly and outwardly to know what is being taken care of, what is being resourced, what is being neglected. You know, and I think to actually almost, you know, you can really sense when actually we are well resourced in terms of caring, our capacities for generosity, our capacities for compassion, kindness, don't really feel to have limits. You know? And those are those unhesitating moments. But when we are under resourced, then we feel that there are limits, or even within the whole, you know, the wholesomeness of generosity, kindness and compassion, the shadow side can start coming in, you know, of, you know, I'm enduring, or I'm heroic, or I'm, you know, I'm boundless, you know, the sort of shadow side can come in, and with that I think fatigue, resentment, you know, feelings of being kind of shortchanged inwardly. So I just think it's quite, you know, it's a big question, and it's not a question of self and other. It's a question of, you know, a sense of care for me is far more significant.
I just wondered, because you talked about noticing moments where there's an absence of self. And I was just, the idea of joy has been around for me. And one part of me says, I know you're not. You'll never be joyful. You're not joyful. Don't even go there. It's too much, too much stuff you need to clean up. But actually, I'd like to start noticing those moments of joy more often, so that, you know, that what I've noticed is in those moments, there is an absence of self. And, you know, I see children playing, or, you know, just taking delight in the moment, and there's no selfing going on. So I guess I'm just wondering about your thoughts about joy and how that's sort of connected to you.
Well, I think it's very connected, actually. You know, and for me, it almost it provokes something I've been reflecting on a lot over the last couple of years. You know, both in teaching and listening to a lot of people who practice. And it's the whole question around the orientation that we take in practice. You know what you said about, I've got so much to clean up, and then joy is going to come as a result of that. I think that's really the orientation I hear so much. And, you know, I don't actually see it really borne out in the text. You know, I think for many people in this culture, you know, our work ethic is so strongly established, you know, that it gets directly transferred into the path. And you know, we've got work to do here. You know, we've got stuff to work on. You know, we really have a lot to work on, you know. And you know, I see people come on into retreats and there's a project on the table right away about what I'm going to work on during this retreat, you know, my issues, you know, my stuff. And, you know, more and more I come to see that as long as the sort of notion of me is kind of quite fixated, that that is actually going to be endless. Because the very notion of a kind of solidified me is always to pick up a new definition. And it's always going to pick up a new definition, which is most often rooted in something which is we deem to be negative or unwelcome, you know. I mean, so, and what I see in the text is that it's a very, very different orientation, is that through actually cultivating the wholesome, the skillful, the healing, the liberating, including all of the Brahma-Viharas and that wider dimension of mudita, which is appreciative joy, that through cultivating all of the qualities of the wholesome, the liberating, this is actually what does the work of relinquishing the unskillful. And it's kind of a question of orientation in practice. It feels very different, you know. If I'm going to sit down on my cushion, I'm going to work on my issues. You know, it feels, to me, and I'm not trying to say there's nothing to, that needs attention, because there's lots that needs attention. But the idea that I'm going to work on my issues when actually I am so entangled and shaped by those issues, how am I actually going to work on those issues? You know, that in a way, it doesn't quite equate. You know, and so it's not at all being dismissive. Yes, there are difficulties that, you know, there are afflictions, there are kinds of afflictive thoughts and emotions. But it feels quite joyless often to me, that perspective. You know, and I even wonder how people continue in the practice, actually. You know, if I feel, you know, oh, another 45 minutes working on my stuff, you know. You know, I don't feel very inspired to me. You know, it just doesn't. And what I read in the text is far more this sense of cultivation, far more this sense of bhavana, this sense of bringing into being. And, you know, of course, what is focused on, you know, in the very word meditation is bhavana, to cultivate. You know, meditation is actually a very poor translation of bhavana. You know, and to actually reframe what we're doing as a path of cultivation. And of course what we're cultivating is everything that gladdens the heart, that removes confusion, that liberates entanglement, that brings a deeper sense of aliveness and vitality and wakefulness into our life. And to have the confidence that that is actually what does the work of relinquishing. Not me assuming an exaggerated responsibility to do that. You know, and I just think to have that reframing, I don't know, for me, I find that considerably more inspiring and indeed joyful than to feel the endlessness of this path of elimination, you know. So I do think, and it's not kind of loopy thinking, you know. It's not about pretending, you know. It's not about pretending I'm joyful or pretending I'm compassionate or, you know, getting in. It's not like an affirmation. It's a genuine cultivation, you know. And, certainly from the perspective of the Buddhist teaching, you know, joy is a seed that lives in every human heart, as much as compassion does, as much as metta does, as much as the seeds of insight, and all live within every human heart. And it's like anyone who's ever grown anything in their life, from a child to a plant, knows that if it's going to grow, you tend to it, you bring it into being. So I do feel it's a really significant shift in. perspective.
Thank you, it's really helpful. I think also this kind of, as a psychotherapist, you know, the mindfulness is coming to psychotherapy, and it all, for me, has gotten mixed up with, you know, working on yourself. And
what can you?
Working on yourself.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of, and yeah, just being, I just sort of find it, I find it difficult to separate.
Yeah, it does get mixed up. But I think it's also the way that mindfulness gets translated. You know, it's been a much more kind of one-dimensional. Whereas, of course, you know, in traditional teachings, mindfulness has a very extended family. You know, it doesn't just sit alone. It has this huge happy family. A happy family, you know, that includes investigation, includes all of the Brahma Viharas, you know, includes attention, but for it to be functional, it functions as a family member and not as something in isolation. That's our time to break for lunch. We'll have some more time.